So, I never had a title for this sermon, but I had to for the PowerPoint. So it's entitled Standing for Truth. Although it has, you'll learn it has a little bit different meaning than just truth. I'll come back to that. So I remember most of my freshman year of high school simply because of one fact. And that was because I made the basketball team. I heard that snicker. I know, short guy, I know, he made the basketball team. But I did. I'm not kidding. It was the only year I tried out, and I made the team. And that's part of why I remember so much of my freshman year of high school. But I remember one thing. I remember one thing about it in particular. Because day one of official team practices, the roster's been released. We're meeting as an official team for the first time. Coach White hands out this piece of paper. And he calls it a contract. It was basically just a glorified set of rules we had to follow and sign. Say, I will follow these rules till the final horn of our last game. But I remember that contract because of one specific rule he stated. I will drink no sugary or carbonated drinks the entire season. It was a soda ban. Because he wanted us to be in our best shape possible, right? And I remember that because freshman in high school, Nate Croswell, loved soda. Mountain Dew was my favorite. Especially the Baja Blast flavor at Taco Bell. Oh my goodness, that was so good. And it was so hard not to go over to the fountain at a restaurant and get a Coke or a Mountain Dew or something. It was so hard not to order a drink, a soda or a tea when my family stopped at a restaurant. I mean, Chili's was our favorite. There was one literally halfway between our house and church, which is where we also went to school. So we're passing this Chili's every day, so we'd stop there a lot. It was so hard not to get something other than water or something like that. It was hard to resist, but I knew it was wrong because I signed that contract, didn't I? I said, I will not do this. And if I did it, I'd be lying. I made it to the end of the season. I didn't drink anything. But the temptation was so hard to resist every single day. You see, the temptation is a real problem for humankind. Because temptation is everywhere. And sin dominates everything in this world, right? The Bible defines sin in three ways: the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. And anywhere we look in this society, we see those three things dominating our culture. And pressure from other people can make temptation even harder to resist. Temptation is rampant. And listen to me very well, fellow Christians. It's not a question of if, it's a question of what. The question is not, are you being tempted? No, no, no. The question is, what are you being tempted? How are you being tempted? Because every person in this world is being tempted to sin every single day. And we will continue to be tempted every single day until Christ calls us home. So even temptation to sin is not sin, but it is what leads us to sin. When we give in. All of us are being tempted. And sometimes it can be difficult to stand up to the temptation. You know what? The same is true of the passage we're going to look at today. So we'll be in Daniel chapter 1, if you didn't realize that earlier from our scripture reading. But let's set the scene of Daniel chapter 1 here, shall we? The year is 605 BC. This is a really long time ago. The northern kingdom of Israel has been wiped out by the Assyrians for a couple years now. Babylon has defeated Judah's ally, Egypt, and now they're moving swiftly on Jerusalem. God's prophecy in Jeremiah had been completed because Nebuchadnezzar came in, he defeated King Jehoiakim, and plundered the temple of God. So let's look at Daniel 1 real quick. Daniel 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the vessels of the house of God. So Nebuchadnezzar defeats Judah and King Jehoiakim. He plunders the temple. And the verse continues, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Nebuchadnezzar brings all he's plundered, the vessels, the gold, the silver, the goblets, everything he's taken from the temple of God. And he takes it to his home country called Shinar. And Shinar, when I researched this, was associated in Jewish culture and Hebrew culture and language with open rebellion against God. That's a slap in the face, isn't it? Not only has the temple of God, of Yahweh, the true God, been plundered, but now everything in it has been placed in the house of a false god in a land that is open, that is associated with open rebellion against God. It just went from horrible to worse for them. So Nebuchadnezzar took these things as a testament of his gods and their power over Yahweh. But we know that to be false, because we all know that God, Yahweh, allowed Nebuchadnezzar to win. It says right there in verse 2, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim to Nebuchadnezzar. We all know that God's prophecy was that Judah would be destroyed for their disobedience against him. So he thinks he's won. But along with the vessels that and everything he took from the temple, Nebuchadnezzar ordered his chief of the eunuchs, Ashpenaz, to take Hebrew youths who were of training age. So look at that word eunuch for a moment. It could mean a literal eunuch, but in this case, I believe it means a government official. So think of Ashpenaz as Nebuchadnezzar's chief of staff. He's in charge of everybody else. So Ashpenaz's task was to find Hebrew youths, teenagers of about 13, 14 years old. And they had to be of noble or royal lineage, and they had to be perfectly healthy. And they had to be really smart and competent guys. Let's look at the verse again. It says, then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. So, like that verse just said, these youths were to be taken back to Babylon and trained in the ways of the Chaldeans. Now, the Chaldeans were the Babylonian wise men. They were astrologers, alchemists, magicians. They also happened to be the royal council for Nebuchadnezzar. And so these youths were to be taken from their home, away from the temple where they've grown up, where they've learned to read the scriptures and love God and obey Him. And they're ripped from their homeland and from that temple, and they're placed in Babylon, and they're made to be Babylonians. They're trained in the literature, the language, everything that the Chaldeans studied. Nebuchadnezzar took these boys from their homeland and made them Babylonians. They weren't Hebrews anymore. They were Babylonians. And so they were to be trained as the Chaldeans, and their training had three facets. The first was they had to go through the same education that the Chaldeans would go through. And their education was to last 3 years. Yes, 3 years, and it was incredibly intense. We will skip verse 5 at the moment, and we'll come back to it. But if you look at the end of verse 5, it says they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. This training was so intense because at the end of it, they were going to stand before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar, who pretty much ruled most of the known world at that point, was going to hand select who he wanted on his court. This was rigorous training. Second, they were to be given Babylonian names. So not only has he removed every part of their culture, but he's also changing their names. They're not Hebrew anymore. They will be Babylonian. Verse 6 says, and among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel, he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Mishael, he called Meshach. And Azariah, he called Abednego. And while these four young men, their names represented attributes of God, Nebuchadnezzar and his men took their names and gave them Babylonian names that represented attributes of their false gods. That's the second facet. The third removed even more sacred Hebrew tradition. The third facet of their training was that they were to indulge in a diet of the king's table. This was the same quality of food that the king ate. We'll come back to verse 5 now. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. The problem was that this meat was like the meat that they were fed was most likely offered to idols before it was served. And probably not all the blood was drained from it. And so those of us who have read Old Testament lore, we've read the Old Testament, we know that that would defile the Hebrews. And if they indulge in this diet, they truly were not Hebrews. They were defiled and they were Babylonians. Nebuchadnezzar was smart in getting what he wanted. So since this meat broke Levitical code, Daniel had a problem with that. Daniel knew that he would defile himself if he partook of the Babylonian diet. So he wanted to stand for truth and resist temptation while he was in the midst of a sinful society. So too is it true for us. We must stand against temptation in our sinful, amidst the sin that we live in today. But how do we stand for truth and resist temptation? How do we follow Daniel's example to obey God? That's where we need to pick up the story. So first of all, in order to resist temptation, we must have a clear purpose. Look at verse 8 real quick. But Daniel resolved or purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Daniel's purpose was clear. He would not eat. He would obey God's commands. That was his clear purpose. So we learn from Daniel that, first of all, we must stubbornly resist temptation. Let's consider Daniel's point. He's in a foreign nation, far from his home in Jerusalem, including the temple where he grew up and he learned to love and obey God. His parents are probably dead. And if they're not, he's far from them. He will probably never see them again. The king was trying to change him, his nature entirely, and turn him from Hebrew to Babylonian. And now his diet has been changed by the force of the king. And all his fellow captives his fellow Hebrew youths, they're indulging in the diet. They're eating the meat. The temptation had to be so great to join in, to just give up. I've looked back at my friends and classmates over the past few years, and I've seen how many of them have given in to temptation. Even some of my college classmates had specific instances where they gave in to temptation, and it cost them dear. I've had friends get kicked out of school. And I went to Bible college. I had friends get kicked out of school because they gave in to a temptation in a specific instance. I remember one story that Coach Garrison would share with us every season. Remember how I've told you at Maranatha, when we came to baseball practice, we had a devotional every day? Well, every year Coach Garrison shared this one. Make wise choices. Don't give in to temptation. Because he gave us a picture, an illustration from his time as a student in Maranatha. Coach Garrison was the catcher, and one season, the ace pitcher for Maranatha Baptist Bible College, comes back after Christmas break and meets with the baseball team and says, "Fellas, I'm not going to be playing this season. I'm leaving. I got my girlfriend pregnant." And that pretty much blew their entire season. And the last thing Coach heard about him was that he was not following Christ anymore. He gave in to his temptation. I lost a best friend because our senior year of high school, he started hanging with the wrong crowd, and started to give in to temptation left and right. And last I heard of him was at our combined graduation party. Since then, he's basically fallen off the face of the earth. I don't think he's even walking in faith anymore. All because he started to give in to his temptation. He did not stubbornly resist temptation. Temptation is always there, but we must resist it. We must have a clear purpose. Daniel's purpose was clear. He resisted the temptation to fit in and violate both his conscience and God's commands. So what temptation is attacking you right now? Like I said earlier, it's not a question of if, it's a question of what. All of us are tempted to sin every day. So think to yourself, how are you helping yourself resist that temptation? What walls, what barriers are you putting up for yourself to protect you so you don't fall, so you don't give in? Is your temptation being increased by some sort of outside force? How clear is your purpose? Better yet, what is your purpose? Daniel's purpose was to obey God and to love Him. I'd say that ought to be our purpose, shouldn't it? Not only should we stubbornly resist temptation, but we must also passionately obey God's commands. And there it is. That needs to be our clear purpose. Those two statements right there. We need to stubbornly resist temptation because we want to passionately obey God's commands because we love Him. And we love Him because He first loved us. And He died for us. Look back at verse 8. It says, "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food." Even in all the midst of all this temptation around him, Daniel was firm in his conviction. He would not eat. And nothing was going to make him do it. Not even Nebuchadnezzar. Some translations say Daniel purposed in his heart. This one says resolve. Whatever word you use, whatever phrase you use there, the Hebrew word for resolve here means determination or inclination. Daniel had made up his mind. He was certain he was not going to give in to temptation. So consider yourself for a moment. Are you going to stand firm, determined, decided in the face of temptation? Are you going to passionately serve God because you're out of love and thus stubbornly resist the temptation that's being thrown your way? You must stubbornly and passionately obey God's commands, even when temptation is irresistible. That is our clear purpose. Not only must we have a clear purpose, but we must have grace in disagreement. So let's look back at verse 8 again. We'll continue on. Therefore, because of his clear purpose, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. And I just realized that I forgot to fast forward this screen. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. Now, as we've established many times before, I'm a ball player. And just like any other sport, in baseball, we have one person, usually a few more, but one person in particular who oversees the game. We call him an umpire, as opposed to referee or official in other sports. And when I was playing, there were many times where I disagreed with said umpire when he called me out on strike three on a ball that was at my ankles, or in the dirt in the other batter's box, and my fleshly, sinful self desperately wanted to get in his face and say, you need to get your eyes checked, Blue. You missed the call. But that's not very gracious, is it? We look at the second half of verse 8. Daniel decided to act on his predicament. He went to Ashpenaz, the chief of the eunuchs, and he asked to be allowed not to defile himself. To me, the wordage of that verse indicates an attitude of respect and grace. The verse literally says, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. This conveys a respectful, tactful, and gracious attitude from Daniel. And given the way his testimony and his life later on, I think we can believe that he would have had the same attitude here that he would have had when he got thrown in the lion's den. Did he come out of the lion's den wanting revenge? No. King Cyrus did. But not Daniel. Came out with respect and grace. And if he had that testimony and that attitude later in life, I think it's safe to believe that he would have had that attitude here in his formative years too. Similarly, we must have an attitude of respect and grace when we disagree with the external influences on our temptation. Remember when I said earlier that when I asked you, is there some sort of external force increasing or, increasing your temptation, making it harder to resist? That outside force could be anything. But most commonly, it's people. Friends. Coworkers. Neighbors. Everybody else. Could be done intentionally or unintentional. But people have a way of making other humans want to do things that they normally wouldn't do. People have an interesting way of making other people give in to them their temptation. Anyone who can influence you and make you feel left out can be this external force. They can make you feel left out, different, or weird because you don't do what everybody else does. When that happens, we must have faith that God will work through our grace. Look at verse 9 again. Daniel 1 verse 9 says, "And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs." When Daniel approached Ashpenaz with grace and respect, God gave him favor and compassion, is what the verse says, with Ashpenaz, because he was faithful to God's command. And God used his respectful and gracious attitude to impact Ashpenaz later on. Now, if we look at verse 10, which I read earlier, we find that Ashpenaz was more fearful of Nebuchadnezzar than he was compassionate to Daniel. And rightfully so, because Nebuchadnezzar was a tyrant. He was known to kill people for crossing him. Take Daniel 3, for instance, the story of the fiery furnace. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow to Nebuchadnezzar's statue, he had them thrown in a fiery furnace. And we all know that God saved them, but that's not the point I'm trying to say at the moment. Nebuchadnezzar was a tyrant, and that's why Ashpenaz feared him more than he had compassion for Daniel. So unfortunately, Daniel's request gets denied here. But the impact that Daniel made on him would come back later. Now, don't get me wrong. When I say, just because I said that our gracious and respectful attitude can have an impact on someone, that does not mean we'll get favor in their eyes, like the passage says. That's simply the scriptures telling us what happened to Daniel. It could happen. Not going to happen every time. We're not always going to get favor in somebody else's eyes because we disagreed with them. We resisted temptation and pressure with respect and grace. But if we disagree with someone and we treat them with respect and grace, that attitude, just like Daniel's, may impact that person who is adding pressure to your temptation. Because some people believe Christians to be judgmental and legalistic. And there are some who are. And I hope that is not true of this church. But if we treat those who are increasing and influencing our temptation with love and respect and grace, we could impact, that attitude may reverberate in their thoughts and impact their view, not just on Christians, but perhaps in their life as well. It confirms to them that, yes, we are different, but it's a good, life-changing difference. And perhaps that truth will allow the Holy Spirit to work in their hearts someday. You never know what one seed of grace can do. So I ask you, do you treat others with respect and grace when you disagree with them or they are pushing for you to do something and you say this is when you say in your heart, this is something I am struggling with temptation. I cannot do this. Do you treat with them with respect and grace when you resist? Perhaps someone you know has a real knack for trying to convince you to do something that is a great temptation for you. Sometimes they don't even know, they don't even realize that they're doing that. If so, are you treating them with respect and grace when you resist that temptation and the pressure that they're adding to you? If you do so, perhaps it will stick out to them later, and God can use that in their life in a tremendous way. So, unfortunately for Daniel, his request was denied. But he had faith that God would use, that God will work through his grace. We must have faith that God will work through our grace. But despite the circumstances we're in, we must also have faith that God will protect us in temptation. When I say that, I mean that God will help us, will help deliver us from that temptation. And I'll tell you what I mean by that in a minute. But look at verse 11 again. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see." Despite being turned down, we just read that Daniel had an idea. So he went to his direct supervisor, Melzar. The King James Version identifies him specifically for us. He goes to Melzar and he proposes this 10-day test, where he and his three friends would eat vegetables, and that Hebrew word for vegetables in the Old Testament means sown things, so it probably included grains as well. So we'll eat vegetables and grains, and we'll drink only water. And everybody else, they can have what the king has given them. And at the end of the 10 days, see who's more physically fit. Because at the end of 10 days, it would have been just enough to see physical results, but not enough to induce the king's wrath. So Daniel had an idea, and he goes to Melzar and he proposes this, and Melzar takes that idea to Ashpenaz, and because of the favor that God gave Daniel in Ashpenaz's eyes, Ashpenaz agreed. So it did come back. God was faithful to Daniel and provided a way out of the temptation. And the same can be said for us. Because God will remain faithful to us by providing a way out of temptation. That's what I mean when I say God will protect us in temptation. He'll give us a way out, a way to resist. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says this: "No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide a way of escape, so that you may be able to endure." Now let's put this in context. Have you ever felt pressured by someone else to give in to a temptation, whether they were doing intentionally or unintentionally? Were you able to find a way to reinforce your denial, to reinforce your resistance to the temptation? Were you able to find a way out? Over one Christmas break, my brother and my friend and I, and his friend and I, I think it was Caleb, his friend, my brother's friend Caleb, my brother Preston, and I, we went to Topgolf in Schaumburg one night because they had what was called a college night. From 8 p.m. to 11 p.m., it was they had unlimited play. You could just keep playing and playing and playing until they kicked you out. They had reserved bays for only the college kids, so you didn't have to deal with all the other groups. And they offered reduced prices on drinks and appetizers. So we got several appetizers that night. And all you had to have for this was a college ID. Well, we all had college IDs, so we were good to go. But when we arrived, there weren't any of the reserved bays available. They were all taken. So we kind of got thrown in with this group of three guys that had already started playing. Well, that half price, that reduced price on drinks and appetizers also applied to alcohol. And these three guys at this bay we got thrown in with, they had a bet going. Whoever lost, whoever had the lowest score each round of Top Golf, you get 20 swings each, and whoever had the lowest score had to buy a pitcher. And so when we got sat down, they asked if any of us were 21. Well, I was 21 at the time. And I said, I am. I said, oh, great, you can jump in on the bet. And I felt pressured. I messed up here, I will admit. I did not say I don't drink. I did not say I didn't want to do it. Because I felt pressured. And this is an illustration of my failure as well as God's faithfulness. Because I should have just stood up, but I didn't. So I prayed real quickly to myself and said, God, please, I know you've promised to deliver me, so please help me. I need a way out. And within a few minutes of that, another bay opened up, and me, Preston, and Caleb, we went over there and we had fun hitting golf balls and eating appetizers and not drinking any beer until 11 p.m. when they kicked us out. That was God's faith. He provided a way out of the temptation, even though I failed. God will never, ever let us be tempted without providing a way out or giving us a temptation that we cannot resist. When you obey God and resist temptation, make sure that you treat those who may be adding pressure to you with respect and grace. God may use you to reach them. Be respectful and gracious. So, when we have confronted the temptation respectfully to those involved, yet stubbornly resisting it, and passionately serving God in the process, we come to our third point, and that is, we must be patient and content with God's will. I guess that says it better. We must rest in God's will. Look at verse 13 again. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine that they drank and gave them vegetables. And once again, I forgot that it's split. So I'm sorry. As the 10 days went by, Daniel was patient with God's plan. That brings us to our first subpoint here. We must be patient while God works. Daniel knew that God would be faithful, but even then, he waited 10 days for the plan to be fulfilled. And he participated in the fast. Daniel was patient with God's will. Friends, when we obey God and we resist temptation, we need to be patient and let God's will play out. And that can provide another source of temptation for us, because it's so hard to be patient and let God work, isn't it? It can be so hard to be patient sometimes. Yet we need to stay focused. And I wish Gene was here. He had to go to work, but I wish Gene was here, because I had the illustration of a hunter. The hunter will sit in his blind for hours and hours, all day if necessary, hoping that something will walk out in front of him. He doesn't even know for sure if he'll see anything. And yet he sits there and waits and waits and waits. Patient. That's the kind of patience we need to have when God is working. We must wait patiently for the results of our obedience. He may decide to remove the source of our temptation entirely. He may decide to remove the external pressure or the people outside who are adding to that temptation and increasing it. Or he may choose to do nothing at all and continue to let us struggle with our temptation, yet grow and trust him more. Whatever he decides, we must wait patiently as God works. And as we wait patiently for God's will, we must also be content with God's commands and decisions. We already read verses 15 and 16 again, but in the story, Daniel and his friends, they looked physically fitter. They had better definition on their muscles by the end of the 10 days. It wasn't enough to invoke Nebuchadnezzar's wrath, but it was enough to see the difference. And so Ashpenaz took away the meat and showed the results to the king. And from that point on, God blessed Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, by giving them wisdom and allowing them to serve on the king's court for years to come after their training was finished. That's what verses 17 through 21 of Daniel chapter 1 show for us. And God also blessed Daniel with the ability to interpret dreams and vision. He did this for Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2. He did this for Belteshazzar in chapter 5. And chapters 7 to 12 are all Daniel's own visions. God blessed him because he obeyed him. He resisted temptation. He was respectful and gracious to those who added to his temptation. And he was patient and content with whatever God worked. Now, if we were in Daniel's position, it would be pretty difficult to complain with these results, right? However, in our particular lives, we might not find the results favorable all the time. We may have to distance ourselves from certain things, activities, or people so that we can resist that temptation. We may be shunned by others for being different. We may lose friends, or they may try to make our lives miserable. Yet, God is faithful to those who obey him. And if we're content with his commands to love and obey him and resist temptation, then we can be content with whatever his decision is. When we are content with these things, we know that God works all things together for our spiritual good, to grow us, to make us more like Christ. That's what Romans 8:28 tells us. That everything we face in this life, that's temptation, that's trials, that's suffering, that's even blessing. Everything in this life, for the Christian, for those who are in Christ Jesus, everything works together for us to become more like Christ. Even resisting temptation. That could be persecution for our obedience. That could be rewards for our obedience. But whatever it is, we can rest assured that God is faithful to work in those who obey him. Be patient and content with God's will, because his way is perfect, and ours is most definitely not. So just like Daniel, we need to have a clear purpose. What is your clear purpose this morning? Is it to love and obey God? Is it to resist temptation because of that love? When we confront the sin or the temptation, or whatever situation we have, maybe it's somebody who's pressuring us, we must be respectful and gracious when we deal with that, when we resist that temptation. Even if it's just ourselves, we need to be gracious. We need to realize that temptation to sin is not sin. I've been guilty of beating myself up for being tempted for something. It's only sin when you give in to the temptation. But we need to be respectful and gracious in disagreement. And then when we deal with the problem, we must be patient and content with God's will. We must stand for truth in the midst of sin by resisting temptation. We need to stand against this false truth that the world pushes, that you can do or be whatever you want, and nobody should ever judge you for doing so. The problem is God can't. And someday he's going to judge sin. And if we don't resist temptation, how can we reach those who are falling into? When pressure to sin comes, when temptation comes, stand for God's truth and obey his commands to love and serve him. So I ask you this morning, will you succumb to the pressure of the world and fall into sin? Or will you stand for God's commands?